University eventually settled on all three in the union's favor, but only after months of delay, involvement of expensive university attorneys, and a threatened shutdown by the FSWs and the PSWs.
That's right!
Because we stood together, and they didn't think we, they thought, they may have thought we was playing, but they soon found out that we were not. And it was things like this. It was coming together in the cold. Some of them temperatures was almost below zero. And we said strong and bold, we gonna stick together even in the cold. And we stuck with it. And you all were supportive. So we want to thank you all for your support. Now this year, the university's employees attempting to join AFSCME as prescribed by state law and policy faced spying, intimidation, and other unfair labor practices by the university officials. False or misleading statements emailed to employees by university officials, and a general climate of disrespect for the right to freely assemble and bargain collectively.
UI doesn't love us, workers. UI doesn't love the workers.
I'm amazed at how you get fired from one job and then get a raise to go do another job. I mean, I'm completely amazed by this. But so that's why we have to stick together. I'm gonna sort of go off the points that were given to me, and I want to go back to something that that said to me on a regular occasion by some people who are union workers. They say, and other administrators say, that we should be happy we have a job. I understand very well what it is to be unemployed, and I understand the pain and struggles of our brothers and sisters who are unemployed. But to me, that's even more motivation for me to fight for the rights of the workers that we maintain our rights to collective bargaining, the benefits, and living wages that we have now, because the unions are the last foothold right now from the assault of privatization that's taking place. And if we don't stick together, there'll be nothing else to fight for.
That's right.
We cannot be passive, we cannot be complacent, because if they'll take it from you in a fight, they'll damn sure take it for you if you don't fight. Okay? So we must fight all the time. We have to stick together. Union solidarity from this day forward. Power to the people, y'all. Yeah.
Tell Quinn to honor his contracts.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. We also, speaking of AFSCME, we have a speaker from AFSCME. Say a few words from us about what...
Well, it's not just because I'm embarrassed by what I was saying there with the camcorder, but it's also just that the audio is a little funky, so maybe I can work on that. I intend to put it up at the UCIMC website at some point, maybe in the video, so you can absorb the prompts, but I was juggling the camcorder a lot, too, so it's a rough cut. That was from the demo this past Tuesday, Valentine's Day. Show Your Love, U of I. What was it again? Give Us Some Love. Speakers, that was Aaron Ammons, of course, of Higher Ground, representing for SEIU. And leading into the labor hour today. Occupy folks later, and I'm going to take it on out of here and take some more nerve pain medicine, I think, and get sillier than I am now. Yeah. Okay.
Let's be silly.
Yeah. It helps.
Down at the local mill, work dried up, not a mill. Francisco. They used to call us working class. We're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org. Hello, folks, and welcome to the February 18th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM and streamed worldwide at weft.org. Views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinion of WEFT's management, board of directors, Prairie Air Incorporated, or the associates. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the Unemployed and Underemployed Helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. It's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, during the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's poem for this week from his Cries for Justice collection will be the one entitled I Am Freedom. Also with us here today is co-founder of the Illinois Labor Hour, Bill Gorell, with some news and commentary. And now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
The General Electric Company has plans to hire over 5,000 veterans over the next 5 years and to invest $580 million to expand its aviation business. The announcements were part of a four-day event that the global conglomerate hosted with partners in Washington, D.C. that focused on issues such as manufacturing and jobs creation in America. GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt chairs President Obama's 27-member Jobs Council, which also includes AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, AOL co-founder Steve Case, and Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg. GE announced that the partnership will help match veterans with jobs. The company, whose products range from jet engines to light bulbs, will also team with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to sponsor 400 veterans jobs fairs this year. GE currently employs more than 10,000 veterans and has about 100 U.S. employee military reservists serving overseas. The company expects to double its number of engineering interns to more than 5,000. The move is part of the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness Initiative to graduate 10,000 more engineers a year in the United States. GE says this often leads to jobs, as 80% of its 19,000 full-time engineers have been hired from the internship programs.
Thanks, Tom. Some locked-out American Crystal Sugar Company workers are joining workers in Ohio locked out by Cooper Tire on a 1,000-mile tour through six states. About 1,300 Crystal workers have been locked out since August 1st last year in a contract dispute, and about 1,000 workers at Cooper's Tires plant in Findlay, Ohio, were locked out November 28th. The bakery workers and United Steel Workers Union are calling this the Journey for Justice, and that tour will start in the North Dakota city of Fargo on Wednesday. The Grand Forks Herald reports that the stops are expected in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and before the tour concludes February 27th in Findlay, Ohio. And rallies, fundraiser, and other events are planned. Cooper Tire has been, these people have been locked out, like I say, since November 28th. They also just recently signed a contract with the United Steelworkers of America Local 556L, and they overwhelmingly ratified a new four-year labor agreement at its Clarksdale, Mississippi facility. And also just recently, Cooper Tire workers in Texarkana reached an agreement with on a new contract with that company. But those 1,100 locked-out workers in Findlay, Ohio remain off the job, and they're going to start this Journey for Justice coming up this week and conclude in February 27th in Findlay, Ohio. Tom?
Hey, once again, food products from the sandwich chain Jimmy John's, which is headquartered in Champaign, have been linked to an outbreak of foodborne illness. The Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention announced last week that 12 cases of E. coli poisoning in five states are linked to raw clover sprouts eaten at Jimmy John's restaurants. Illnesses in the current outbreak were reported in Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, and Wisconsin, and they occurred between December 25, 2011 and January 15, 2012, and two of the victims were actually hospitalized. In December of 2010, Jimmy John Leotard of Champaign, the chain's owner, sent letters to franchises asking its Illinois stores to pull alfalfa sprouts from its menu following an investigation into a salmonella outbreak at that time. In that occurrence, many people who became ill with salmonella reported having eaten alfalfa sprouts at Jimmy John's restaurants in 10 Illinois counties, amongst them Champaign County. After the salmonella outbreak a little over a year ago, the company said it would switch from using alfalfa sprouts to clover sprouts because they are easier to clean. But federal regulators are warning against eating all sprouts because they are one of the most frequent perpetrators of foodborne illness.
Oh, by the way, speaking of foodborne illness, keep in mind that in Minnesota, there have been many workers trying to organize Jimmy John's through the IWW, and one of the major issues is sick leave.
Right.
Sick days.
Yeah, and that's where the NLRB voided that election that they held that actually with just a narrowly turned down the union, but the NLRB said there was some election fraud going on there by that company. So,
yeah, and also, too, I'm boycotting Jimmy John's on his attitude about the taxes in Illinois. I mean, that just outrages me. I know he went to Eastern University. I'm sure he went to a public schools, grade school and high school, and then to try to make a bunch of money starting in this state and benefiting from this state, and then coming out saying that he's thinking about moving to Florida because they raise the income tax 1%. Well, they raise it the same on me, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that brings up a couple stories. One, I remember when that whole thing came out about Jimmy John, and he was proclaiming what a great American he was and talked about his dad closing a factory in the Chicago suburbs back in the 70s or 80s and moved 600 jobs down to Mexico. So.
Oh, so apparently he was obviously born on third base, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Dad has a 600-person factory. He could move to Mexico. Wow.
And then the news did come out this week that Caterpillar was putting that plant in Athens, Georgia, rather than here in Illinois. I think we talked about that last week, that they had already decided it wasn't going to be here in Illinois.
But the Canadian locomotive plant, or
moving the plant from Japan that makes these small tractors or something
really?
Like that, and they're bringing jobs from Japan back to the United States. They just announced this week that they're putting it in Athens, Georgia. But though they cited business conditions in Illinois as one of the factors, the first point they bring out in their story this week is that they like the ports around Athens, Georgia, and the fact that they had access to ocean and stuff easily through Athens, Georgia, rather than here in Illinois.
So. Seaborne materials.
Yes.
Well, yeah. that makes sense, and actually, I hope that is the case, because that gets us back to the good old days where businesses were located due to intrinsic and unique possibly attributes of the place, the geography, what resources are there, rather than the race to the bottom between the 50 states of
to
tax
see who
giveaways.
Can give, yeah, more taxes away.
Yeah, and of course, the South is less labor-friendly in general right. than Illinois is.
That's why so many people these days are saying buy local stuff so it doesn't have to be shipped as far and
that's
things
right.
like that.
So I'm really hoping that we get to the point where we have enough sustainably generated electricity to have giant greenhouses growing stuff for us like coffee.
Yeah.
Instead of shipping it from South America.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on.
All right. I got a story here. The Teamsters Union said Monday that its members at Wonder Bread and Twinkies maker Hostess Brands have voted to authorize a strike if a bankruptcy judge approves the company's request to cut their health care and pension benefits. Local unions representing the more than 7,500 Hostess workers held strike authorization votes over the past 10 days. And a majority of the members took part in a vote, with over 90% of those voting electing to authorize a strike, the union said. Actually, Teamsters Local 734 in the Chicago area authorized on the strike on February 11th. They voted by an overwhelming vote of 190-1. It turns out that this Hostess Brands filed for bankruptcy on January 11th. And the Hostess made a motion to withdraw from the Teamsters' multi-employer pension funds, reduce worker benefits, and alter its collective bargaining agreements. And a hearing is scheduled to begin March 5th, and the judge has 30 days to issue a ruling. Now, back in 2009, Local 734 Hostess employees sacrificed more than $132 a week in base pay to draw the bakery giant out of bankruptcy. In the current filing for Chapter 11 protection, Hostess is shifting the focus of its attack from workers' wages to health and welfare and retirement benefits. The company already owes Local 734 more than $2 million in past due pension contributions after ceasing its payments to the funds back in July of 2011. So, anyway.
Well, I think those probably travel well enough. They could make them in China.
Hostess Twinkies?
Yeah,
I don't think there's any expiration date on those things, are there? Anyway, Tom, you got a story over there?
Yeah, a brief one here. It's a commemoration. Like everybody has heard of the Tuskegee Airmen. And for Black History Month, I'm not sure, is it February or March that was Black History Month?
February.
That's what I thought. Yes. Well, anyway, Tuskegee Airmen were not from Tuskegee, Alabama. They were from Chanute Air Force Base in Rantoul, Illinois. On March 19, 1941, the 99th Pursuit Squadron was activated at Chanute. In 1942, the squadron moved to Tuskegee Air Base in Alabama, where its members became known as the Tuskegee Airmen. Chanute trained the first 278 African-American airmen in United States history. So that was... they were heroes. They helped us win the war.
There you go. I got a story here actually out of Italy. It's a Swiss billionaire and a Belgian baron have been found guilty and sentenced to 16 years each in prison by an Italian court in a groundbreaking trial over 3,000 alleged asbestos-related deaths. Two gentlemen's name, and I'm going to murder them here. Stephen Schmidhaney, the former owner of a company called Eternit. They made asbestos fiber cement. And Jean-Louis Marie Gislain, he's a major shareholder, were sentenced in absentia after being found guilty of causing an environmental disaster and failing to comply with safety regulations. The verdict was handed down after a two-year trial, and through a network of subsidiaries and affiliates, Eternit became the largest manufacturer of asbestos cement products in the world. But along with the tremendous fortunes the companies generated for their owners came death and disease for thousands of employees, families, and neighbors. The company was founded more than a century ago by an ancestor of Descartier. They fined these people. They're sending them to jail for 16 years. They fined these people as much as several million dollars. The one gentleman, the Baron, is 91 years old, and they're sending him to jail for 16 years. So we'll see if he makes that. But what the main part of the case is that years after people knew there were hazards from asbestos, this manufacturer continued to subject their workers to working with this asbestos products and stuff, and just continued to jeopardize their workers' lives and health. So that's what goes on in a lot of companies. Anyway, let's go to some music. Bill picked out a song here from Guitar Shorty. It's We the People.
My job. Boss said, shorty, don't need you no more. Work 20 years, give it all you got. What's a man supposed to do? Lie, cheat, and run. In the morning, go down to the store. Prices are getting higher. I can't take it no more. Got my guitar, try to bend a note. I look at my neck and even my strength.
Come here.
And now, we've reached that part of the program, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And Tom's poem for this week is I Am Freedom.
I have no legs, yet still I dance, because it's what I need to do. With every breath I take a chance, it is the last and I'll be through. I have no wings, yet still I fly, soaring high in each human heart. Your need means I can never die, and never from your world part. I have no heart, yet still I love, no matter what they've done to me. My soul's alive, here and above, where some are saying I should be. I am the right to draw a breath, and not to have it poison me. And so should it be for all time, when all the universe is free. I am the long and open road, down which so many dreams have come, to lighten up a bitter load by silencing war's throbbing drum. I am the tyrants driven out and punished for their evil crimes. I am that for which people shout to bring us back to freer times. I am the property of all, even those few who were so dumb they caused my temporary fall. I will come back, for I am freedom. I Am Freedom was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 4th, 2008. And was brought to you live today, February 18th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. And a couple of public service announcements for you here. Reminder that you can catch Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday on Comcast Cable Channel 6 at 4 p.m. Features normal host of the Illinois World Labor Hour, David Johnson, and friend of the show, Jim Iman, bringing you some important labor news and videos every Sunday at 4 p.m. on Cable Channel 6. And this is probably a good time to remind you that we can bring our community together as WEFT 90.1 FM and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank collaborate for our fourth annual radio food drive. Donations can be made online at weft.org, or you can send in your contribution to WEFT PO Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois. That zip code is 61824-1223. And a reminder that for every $10 donated to the station, WEFT will donate $1 to the food bank, and that $1 is then able to purchase up to $10 worth of food for families in need throughout the Central Illinois area. The food bank serves 46,000 clients in a 14-county region, and many of these people find themselves having to make choices between paying for food, housing, medication, or fuel. And also another little kind of public service announcement for Jobs with Justice. Normal host of the show, David Johnson, was trying to solicit people to come out to the Jobs for Justice meeting this Saturday morning at 10 a.m. They're very involved with what's going on at Flexengate with the workers there, trying to get union brought into Flexengate. There was an issue going on this week where some of the Congolese and employees at Flexengate were seemingly getting asked to or being told they couldn't renew their leases at their place where they live on Mattis Avenue with Royce and Brinkmeyer. And apparently enough people got calls in and sent emails and whatnot to the folks at Royce and Brinkmeyer, and they reversed course and went ahead and will go ahead and offer leases to these people rather than kicking them out. So that's good community action having good effect for people. So
we're gonna, making much fewer people homeless.
Yeah. We're going to quickly go to a little bit of Workers Independent News for Friday and then come right back. And Bill's got a good little audio clip that we're going to play here. So stay tuned, Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin progressives, labor activists, and grassroots supporters of Governor Scott Walker's recall commemorated the one-year anniversary of last February's historic protests this week. Those protests, including a weeks-long occupation of Wisconsin's state capitol, were the largest sustained pro-labor protests in U.S. history. As more than a million recall signatures against Walker are reviewed and validated, the Wisconsin AFL-CIO is out with a report called Losses to Working Families Under Governor Walker. The Labor Federation says Walker campaigned promising to create jobs, but instead has become job killer in chief. Wisconsin has lost jobs 6 months in a row. At one of the rallies marking the Wisconsin uprising's one-year anniversary, Democratic State Representative Peter Barca expressed the determination of the grassroots Wisconsin uprising.
One year stronger. Yeah. You know, Governor Walker predicted that eventually we would come to accept his changes. Yeah. He thought in 6 months we would forget. Yeah. Governor Walker, not in 60 years would we forget. Yeah.
A big rally is planned for March 10th at the Capitol in Madison. The one-year longer, one-year stronger actions this week in the Reclaim Wisconsin bus tour of the state, culminating in that March 10th rally, are meant to reconvene the empowered community that launched Wisconsin's Capitol occupation and statewide protests last year. It's expected to reinvigorate the solidarity and spirit of cooperation of the historic grassroots Wisconsin uprising as the recall election against Governor Walker draws near. Hundreds of nurses at McLaren Greater Lansing Hospital in Michigan have voted to stay loyal to their union, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. An independent nurses group challenged the OPEIU representation. OPEIU 459's Joseph Marudiak.
There was a group of independent nurses who attempted to raid this group and to convince them that they would be better off in an all-nurses union, and that OPEIU, since we have other professionals in our union, wasn't the right place for nurses. And the nurses soundly rejected that and decided that OPEIU is good representation for them.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It is well.
All right, we're back, and Bill's going to introduce this audio clip that he's got for us. Bill, what's
Yeah, well, I've noticed this month, which is Black History Month, we haven't had very little Black history because things happen, you know, and things come up. But anyway, this week, you know, especially since David and Pat aren't here, I would fill a little time with about 25 minutes of a man known as General Baker, and I'll read a little introduction for him, and this is off a website called speakersforanewamerica.com. General Gordon Baker is a national and internationally known labor leader who has been called the most important 21st century American revolutionary. He was a leader of the Detroit Wildcat strikes in the 1960s, a founder of the legendary League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, and the first American to refuse induction to fight in Vietnam. His case was a landmark in draft resistance, symbolizing the beginning of the anti-war movement. The book, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, calls General Baker the, quote, soul of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. The ideas emanating from that period inspired black auto workers throughout America. General Baker's lifelong commitment to the working class makes him one of the country's most knowledgeable spokesmen for a new society where workers will finally receive the fruits of their labor. An auto worker for 30 years, he remains a champion of the unemployed and unorganized workers. Today, he discusses the necessity of building a national movement to take over the giant corporations before they take over the people. General Baker and his family were featured in The American Dream, a documentary about labor history. Other accomplishments include running a Michigan statewide campaign for political office, and so on and so forth. He's a very accomplished man. And what he will be talking about in this clip here, this is actually called From Motown to Coal Town, the West Virginia-Detroit connection. Hmm. And what he's going to be talking about is a history of organizing auto workers in Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, about the migration of Southern black workers to Detroit. As he says, if he wanted to play and dance and so on and so forth, he went to Chicago. But if he wanted to work, he went to Detroit.
Going to get me a job on that Cadillac assembly line.
That's right. And actually, it wasn't only black people, too. Like, especially this part of the country here, many people I know that are United Auto Workers members in Decatur, say at the Caterpillar plants, were basically redneck. Their ancestors were rednecks out of Kentucky and right. Tennessee quite often. Right. But anyway, we'll get to General Baker here. We'll be short on time. Very interesting man. And anyway, are you about ready to
cue him? I think we're ready to go, yeah.
You got him cued? Here he comes. By the way, folks, he's going to be saying the word Chicago occasionally. Chicago is the nickname of the camera operator.
Chicago, I really don't know. I was named after my father. But what you're asking now is how my father got that name. And that's what I never learned. I never learned from my father. He didn't really know. I was born in Detroit. My family, both my mother and my father's side of the family, were from sharecropper families in Georgia. Mom and Dad met. They moved to Augusta. They were married in Augusta. My older sister was born in Augusta, Georgia. And there, my mom and Dad worked as a sort of like as a maid, yard keeper couple, kind of like in the new movie Help. You know, except it was a couple. My mom and Dad worked there. Dad told me that at that time he earned $6 a week. His dream was to get to Detroit to get him a job in these auto companies because he had a brother who had came from there and went up there, and he'd get letters back. His brother was telling about how life was and the money he could make and stuff like that. So that was Dad's dream. So my dad and another uncle on my mother's side, one of my mother's brothers, they both came up here to Detroit. I think it must have been about, January of 41. Both got jobs, first in construction and then went into the auto industry. And Dad sent back and got my mom in April of 41. And I was born in September. So that's the transition the family made. But Dad's dream was, we did a movie together called American Dream, and they highlights my family. They wanted a family where they could show three generations in the auto industry. So they had my dad, myself, and my daughter at that time that was working at the Jefferson Assembly Plant. So they went into a lot of depth in there. And Dad, on that movie, talks a lot about how his dream, his American dream, was to get the hell out of Georgia, get up here to Detroit, get him a job so he could buy him a house and raise his family. So in that sense, Dad was able to complete his American dream. What we're talking about really is the history of Detroit, really, and the struggles that workers went through here in this city. The city, Chicago, if you look at it now, it's not the city it used to be. We used to be Auto Town. And when I say Auto Town, I mean that in the strictest sense of the word, because they had so many auto plants here some of them that don't even exist today, right? Like Calvinator, Nash, Hudson, Studebaker, all those cars that no longer exist, they had plants here making them, you know? Those plants existed alongside the Big Three, you know? As a matter of fact, in the early days of the Big Four, it was General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, and American Motors. American Motors, you know, at that time had the Jeep and the Rambler. That was their cars, and they were called the fourth largest company. So this used to be a real concentration of auto plants here in the city. And it was a city that you came to, when I talked to my father and all of them, they say, you came to Detroit because you wanted to work, you know. The people that left the South coming north, if you wanted to play or gamble and dance, and you went to Chicago. Well, if you want to work, you brought your butt to Detroit. So it had a history like that. I mean, people knew what they came here for. The composition of the city that we live in now, a lot of it was the work of Henry Ford himself. Because Henry Ford, when he built that great big Ford complex out in Dearborn in 1928, his strategy was to keep the workforce diversified, and that diversification was a hedge against unionization. He figured if he had Italians here and Irishmen here, you know, and Middle Easterners here and blacks here and all like that, that was a hedge against organizing. If they couldn't communicate, then they couldn't organize. So part of the reason that you got so many blacks in the population now, because Henry Ford recruited a lot of blacks at that plant so that he could make it really diverse. Chicago, to show you how diverse it became, in 1941 when it was organized, we had 17,000 black workers in the foundry. But the whole Rouge had almost 100,000 people in it. But with 17,000, you got almost a fifth of that workforce at Henry Ford, at Ford, was black, and mainly concentrated in the foundries and open heart, you know. So part of the diversification was his doing in order to keep the thing from being unionized, you know. Ford was the last one of the big three to get a union in it. You know, they had organized GM and Chrysler before they could tackle Ford. And when they first went after Ford, they were defeated badly. And that's what's called the Battle of the Overpass in 1937, when the union went in to try to organize the Ford plant and got beat back by Henry Ford and his thugs. You know, Henry Ford had a guy named Harry Bennett that handled the security at the Rouge plant. He had 8,000 people on his payroll. So he had 8,000 people that was just in the security operations at Ford Motor Company. And it was notorious, some of the stories about Harry Bennett. Harry Bennett was an ex-gangster of the like of the Capones and people that came out in that period of time. And he was an architect man of it, and he done a good job to keep that plant free of unions. Now, the other plants in the city, you know, Chrysler had, man, maybe 29 plants. GM had maybe a dozen plants, you know. You had American Motors. We had like I said, a big Packard plant over on the east side. We had Hudson plant. We had Kaiser Frazier. We had all those plants here. The Studebaker plant, even though its concentration was in Indianapolis, we had a small Studebaker plant here in the city. So we had all these, and then not only did you have those name plant Chicago, but you know, the auto industry always had these little spinoff plants. You know, Briggs Manufacturing, I can't even think of some of the names, Kelsey Hayes, a whole lot of other little plants that made different components for auto that was associated with it. So it was a real concentration, man, of auto plants and auto workers in this town. And part of the struggle that we had, most of them didn't have the kind of penetration of blacks in them that Ford Motor Company did, because Henry Ford had a plan, you know, and his plan on diversification was to keep them from being unionized. And what happened was that when Walter Reuther and them went to the Ford plant in 1937, because, you know, okay, we had the sit-down strike in 37 up in Flint. You know, that's historic about the Flint sit-down and Fisher Body number one. Their whole story is written about that, you know, about that effort there. We got a real unity, man, because it's the coal miners that organize auto workers. If it don't be the coal miners, the auto workers probably never would have been organized, man. John L. Lewis brought a core of coal miners up here to help with these union drives, and it's real important. Because one of the stories they got up at in Flint was that when the governor had called out the National Guard, John L. Lewis flew up and stood in the windows at the plant and said, "If you're gonna open fire, you got to shoot me first." Bared his chest. I mean, it was that kind of solidarity that went into the organizing drive of the auto workers. And if it don't, I mean, John L. Lewis took the dues paying money of the coal miners and built the CIO, you see? And that's a hell of a job and a hell of a task to do. And obviously, in order to do that, you had to convince the coal miners that that's necessary. That in order for us to grow this movement, we're going to have to support the other sections of the industrial working class in this country, else we're going to fail. We'll be standing out here by ourselves. So the whole CIO pretty much was built with the backing of the dues paying coal miners. You know, and that's an important piece of history that people try to gloss over all the time and not talk about. But just last week we had, Cecil Roberts? Isn't Cecil Roberts the international president of the mine workers right now? He was up here last week to a rally we had. And he came up and he talked about that. And I was glad he came because we got so many people in these auto unions and other unions that don't know that history. They don't know the role the coal miners played in organizing us up here. And I was so glad to hear him stand up there and say that, you know, so that I could go back and check in certain people, you know, to see the history of it and how important the coal miner and auto worker connection was. And it just surprised me. We had a Cecil brought with him this black coal miner that's on the executive board of the coal mines. And he told the story of this guy, and I was shocked because I knew the guy, but I didn't know the history. History he had. He said that his dad was one of the few black coal miners they had in the mines back in the 30s. And he went in the mines and he worked. He was an active member of the union. And he got hurt and I understood. Cecil said that he bought a coal mine with the money he got from being hurt. And he employed about 100 people and he made sure it was unionized. You know, but he went on to tell that story about him, and then he said he had a son, and his son was the guy that's now on the International Executive Board of the Coal Miners Union. He had him at the meeting with him. I can't remember his name, but I remember him. I met him back in 89, back in 1989, during the big coal strike. We organized up here, you know, out of our local and our international union, what was called the from Motown to Coal Town, and we took a 200 car caravan from here down to the coal fields in support of the strike down there. And that's how I got a chance to meet that other guy that was a coal miner then. He wasn't on the executive board, but he was a coal miner then. But it's kind of important. But anyway, I'll just highlight, and I think the strength and solidarity we had between coal miners and auto workers that stood over the decades, without a lot of the auto workers realizing, you know, the kind of connections and the kind of solidarity that existed between the two, and how important the coal miners were for us. If you ever go out to my local union, Local 600, we got pictures up and down the wall of the Ford organizing drive that took place in 1941, and we got pictures of Wetman, I think his name was. There was a coal miner that was sent up to help organize Local 600. The last name was Wetman, but they got pictures of him on the wall too, along with the organizing drives and meetings that were taking place in order to get Ford unionized.
On, Bill.
Yeah, hey, we're listening to General Baker telling us the history of organizing the auto workers in Detroit. He was a great radical revolutionary and a founder of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement in Detroit in the late 1960s. Well, let's get back to it.
What happened at the Rouge plant was different than what happened at all the rest of the plants. The Rouge plant was the most difficult to organize because you had so many black workers in the foundry. A lot of it has to do with, if you look strategically at how the Rouge plant is situated, you know, and organized up and down Miller Road. We had a large foundry that sat on the Miller Road side of the plant, and that's where all the big concentration of black workers were in that foundry, and it was the critical place where pickets were going to take place, because the main gate was Gate 4, which is right at the end of the foundry. And what happened was that Harry Bennett's strategy during the organizing strike in 41 was to try to turn the organizing strike into a race riot. So Bennett had hired a bunch of black thugs and put them in the foundry, act like they was working. You know, and in preparation for this strike, when it started, he wanted these blacks to run out and attack the organizers and turn the thing into a race riot, have the governor of the state then call out the National Guards and use that to crush the whole effort to unionize. So the battle became one of winning over these black workers in the foundry, you know, and it was really strategic, and we did a lot of work was done. They organized preachers in the city. They flew Paul Robeson in to sing down at the Olympia Stadium, you know, and entertainment. We had preachers at the gate, Gate 4, preaching sermons all day long to these blacks in the foundry, winning them over to the union cause. You know, we had the two local black newspapers that was brought into the cause. They opened up union halls in the black community. Union halls right on the street, and one on the east side, one on the west side, so workers could be recruited from the neighborhood and not just from the plant. So, you know, it was a massive effort thrown in together for solidarity around that thing, and it worked. When the first pickets came out, they sent some of those strike breakers out of the plants to attack them, but they fought them off. After they fought them off, after a couple of days of agitations, about 5 days, all of those black workers stormed out of the foundry and joined the strike, you know, and the issue was settled. So Fort Rouge, the Rouge plant, and the Rouge workers became a real different grouping than the rest of the Chrysler plants, GM plants that exist. We had a real solidarity out of the Rouge over the race question. You know, blacks and whites were really united out of practical struggle, because people understood that if we hadn't been united, we'd have been defeated. Now, that same kind of example didn't exist necessarily at GM and at Chrysler and some of the other plants. And so by the time you develop and go up historically, you got a different kind of combination. Like when they first brought, during the war years, in 1943, when they first brought black workers into the Packard plant on the final assembly line, whites walked out, refused to work with them. Did the same thing at a couple of GM plants. Well, at Ford, you had a different kind of solidarity. All that stuff had been done before, and you didn't have no protests and stuff like that, you know? So Ford, the Ford local became quite different than the rest of the locals in the development of the history of the city. And it became an important prop later on in Chicago when we got to the 60s. The Ford local provided a real, was the most militant of the locals all the time, and provided a real beacon of social consciousness and stuff in the city where some of the other locals were more backward. I ended up Chicago. Now I'm a retired auto worker. I ended up working in the plants for about 40 years. I hired in 63 and I retired in 2003. But like I tell you, I got fired from Ford three times, Chrysler twice. So my seniority wasn't one smooth collection of years, you know, and I got fired most of the time in practical struggles, wildcat strikes and things that we call overworking conditions and organizing issues like that. All of them were for the same reason. I mean, once I got fired the first time, I got blacklisted, and then so when I go back in again and they discover me, they fire me again. So I ultimately ended up Chicago having to go out and get a new name, new social security number, sneak back into Ford plant, get a job. By that time, I'd learned the contract language that said that on falsification of application in the Ford system, you had to survive. If you could get away with it for 12 months, you're okay. That means they had a statute of limitations that they agreed upon. If you falsify an application and you get away with it for over a year, you're all right. But if you're caught short of that, then the company got a right to discharge you. What they said is that it's wrong to falsify. But it's also wrong for this falsification to stand over you all the days of your life. So therefore, we need a time limitation on this thing that would provide a statute of limitations. You know, and so that's what we ended up having. And that's why it ended up being a 12-year rule. The way I understood it, that GM and Chrysler, it became 18 months. So Ford had a stronger language than the other two. So I worked, I got that new name into Social Chicago. I went in there and I worked for 19 months before they caught up with me. And somebody finally told on me. And they called me in, they had a stack of pictures of me like that from the old Chrysler plants at the other name. They had a collection of my employment applications from the different Ford plants and Chrysler plants. And they told me they were going to fire me for securing employment under use of an alias, which ain't nothing but a fancy name for falsification. So I was discharged. I stayed in the street 16 months waiting for my case to go to the Empire. And when it finally went to the Empire, we won. At least we've got a split. I got my job and my seniority, but no back pay. I didn't get the back pay for the 16 months I was in the street, but we took the job and the seniority with my name back, and I went on back to work. And that's why I was able to finish my tenure at Ford, you know, with my right name and all that kind of stuff. So I ended up retiring on a disability retirement in 2003. And they gave me credit for 29.7 years seniority, even though I worked in and out of different shops for 40 years. Obviously, the Chrysler time, I had almost 5.5 years of Chrysler. Chrysler time is not portable to Ford. You know, those pension funds are set up separately, so you can't transfer funds from one auto plant to the other, because the company holds the pensions, not the unions. You know, so that's the way that worked. So anyway, that was my tenure in Chicago in terms of my involvement in these struggles here in the city. The struggles here in the city of Chicago, it's a long, long story of all the work that was done and the fights that we had, the unity with the struggles in the community that we had to bring to bear on the struggles inside the shops. You also wouldn't have survived.